It's our pleasure to have you with us, have Scott and Kirk with us here today. How are you, fellas?
Good, thank you.
Terrific.
I have a cold.
Uh-oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
No, it's all right. It happens, so I'm good.
I was bewildered today with the news. You know, we were following this political campaign, and everybody wants to talk now about a Trump-Clinton presidential run. And yet, last time I checked, the last state to be contested on the Democratic side, and in fact, most of the most recent states has been won by Bernie Sanders, haven't they?
Yes, they have. But don't let things like that get in the way.
Okay. And weren't we being told that there was absolutely no chance whatsoever that Trump would get to the magic number of 1,200 and whatever it was, 37 delegates?
1,237, yeah.
Yeah, 1,237, that it was just no chance he would ever do that?
Pretty much they said you could bet on it.
Yeah, I got that wrong, didn't they?
Yep.
Yeah, and old Ted Cruz comes up with, makes a deal with the devil and says to Kasich, if you refrain from campaigning in Indiana, you know, then I'll go mano a mano with Trump and we'll whoop him. And he got $6 million worth of outside money, of PAC money, to run negative ads against Trump. I mean, you imagine running $6 million of ads in one state over a one-week period?
Well, I'd love to be in advertising.
Oh, my God. I mean, it would have to be more than half of the ads run during that period of time were to accuse Trump of all manner of things. And so after spending $6 million, Trump spends $900,000. They spent $6 million trouncing Trump. And he has this deal with the devil. I'm going to go up against him all by myself because the Lord told me that's the way. Of course, he has introduced his mother as the prayer warrior, and she's such a warrior she can hardly walk. She's just bent over and crippled.
It was a rough war.
It was a rough war. and he gets trounced. And so he says, we gave it all we got. And he's the only presidential candidate ever to nominate a vice presidential candidate, a running mate, after having struck the iceberg. It's like, you know, the Titanic, Captain Smith saying, you know, this would be a good time to get a first officer.
Yeah. On my next voyage, we're going to do this differently.
any candidates that want to go down with me?
On my next voyage, we're going to do this one differently.
And Fiona was so desperate, she actually said, oh, sure, I'm going to go down with you. Why not? I'm desperate for attention. And so they would withdraw from the race, and that leaves John Kasich. Now, John Kasich happens to be the only person in human history to come in fourth in a two-man race. It was now a two-man race, and he was in fourth position.
So he
comes out the next day and says he's going to withdraw too because the Lord has something special for him, but he doesn't know what the Lord has for him because it was the Lord that told him that he should run, and now that he got his wires crossed, he's wondering what the Lord has in mind for him.
Their Lord, sure.
Right here, I need to say, Hosea 16. You know what it says, Yahweh shall not refer to me. Shall refer to him as an individual. Lord ever again.
Don't ever call me the Lord again. Ever.
I will remove the Lord's name out.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, it is interesting, however, that the Trumpster, who was pretty subdued about the whole thing, he's interviewed by Wolf Blitzer of CNN the following day in his office. So Wolf gets to right up the big escalator to the top of Trump Tower. And there he is interviewing Trump. And, you know, he said, you know, people have been in politics all their lives and they can't pull off this kind of a victory. As a matter of fact, old Trumpster, that's not what he called him, but he was actually happy to be up there. He said, you know, that you ran against the deepest and most credible field the Republican Party has ever mustered for president. And there were multiple senators, multiple governors, some of the most acclaimed people in the Republican Party. It never had a deeper or broader cast of characters, 17 of them. And you blew them all away. You know, how is that even possible that a neophyte, a guy that's never been in politics, would do that? Now, Trump didn't have an answer, but I'm going to provide you with one. The best in America don't engage in politics. The worst in America engage in politics. The best in America don't teach. The best in America don't preach. The best in America don't go off to war and play soldier. You know what the best in America do? The most capable, the most devoted, the smartest and the most effective people in America, what do they do?
Well, outside of the Covenant Group, they work hard.
Yeah, they engage in business.
They engage, yeah.
They engage in business.
Mm-hmm.
They build things. Mm-hmm. They engage in business. They create value. The reason that Trump, who stumbled all over his tongue, who said some really stupid stuff and some stuff that was smart, but he didn't know how to back it up, prevailed over a whole menagerie of politicians is because he was the lone businessman in the group.
Mm-hmm.
America's best. Engage in business. The very thing that politicians, you got Bernie Sanders out there saying it's not fair. It's not fair that the richest 1%, they're getting 90% of the increase in wealth in America. Well, you better clone what they're doing then, pal.
Yeah. Why not copy them?
You need to find out what they're doing that's working and get other people to do it. A man that's never had a job in his life, but he's going to tell you how to run the economy. I mean, it's just so amazing that people don't get it.
Well, you saw where Hillary was talking about into the coal miners.
Oh yeah,
and the thing that I took away from that, what she offered at the end was, I know your jobs are being lost
because of politicians like me in the administration that I worked in. Shut it down. I shut it. You know, the administration I worked for shut you down. That's why you don't have a job.
But she said, "But I'm willing to send y'all over $30 billion, you know, to ease the pain." And I'm thinking, you know, think about that just a minute. I mean, number one, you wipe them out and then you pay them off,
right?
You pay them off with money that you had to borrow,
right? Yeah, and that makes them dependent.
Who worked it on the mines to begin with, and all the people that had tech? Come on,
yeah. And then you have Paul Ryan comes out yesterday. And he says, no, I'm not going to endorse Donald Trump. Not ready for that. I won't endorse Donald Trump unless he can show me that he can unify the party, that he can run on the principles that we all stand for.
Good.
That he can honor the party of Lincoln. And Lincoln was as much a Republican as John Kennedy was a Republican. The party of Reagan, they just have this love affair with Reagan. I mean, the man that had seances in the White House and consulted astrologers, but they're all in love with Reagan. And Jack Kemp, that was the third person. Now, Jack Kemp was a decent quarterback, but as a politician, he was a flop.
One of these things is not like the other, but I love that they always point to Lincoln, the party of Lincoln. Okay, you do not want to be the party of Lincoln.
No, you don't.
Shattering myth, we went through that whole thing.
Oh, man, how he's everything about Lincoln is a fraud.
Oh,
the guy was a repulsive racist, and it was his mismanagement of the country that led to 650,000 Americans losing their lives, devastating the South.
Well, he brought the personal income tax. He had to borrow. He couldn't.
Right.
He couldn't get a loan, so he floated dollars for the first time against the Constitution. So you can't have paper money.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
And
yeah, he was
that, and they had to pay that off. And I got it. So it's the debt.
Right. To claim Lincoln, you'd have to be an income poop. And this is the same guy, Paul Ryan, that now he's the majority leader of the not majority leader, he's Speaker of the House. Mm-hmm. And so until about a day ago, he was the head of the Republican Party, de facto head. Now the de facto head of the Republican Party is Donald Trump, as the presumptive nominee of the party. And so he's having a little tizzy fit. When Trump said, you know, there's a problem with Muslims, and we need to have a period of time where we forced all Muslims coming into the country until we can figure out what this problem is. Now, what he should have said is 99% of all terrorist acts are perpetrated by Muslims. And since they're all doing so, screaming Allahu Akbar, confessing to the crime, and there's no confusion whatsoever that it's Muslims who are promoting and claiming and perpetrating 99% of the world's terrorist acts, there is a serious problem that the world wants to deny. And if I am President of the United States, I am not going to shirk my responsibility and have Americans be more vulnerable to those who commit 99% of the world's terrorist act. If you're a Muslim and you don't like that, then you need to figure out a way to keep fellow Muslims from perpetrating 99% of the world's terrorist act. When Muslims perpetrate 25% of the world's terrorist acts, then we can have a conversation. But between now and then, no more.
Yeah.
That's all he had to say. But when he said that, Ryan said, oh, that's not Republican. That's not conservatism. It's unconstitutional. It's not unconstitutional to say who and who cannot come into the country.
Why can't you say who can come into the country?
Yeah, he didn't say you can't be a Muslim anymore in America.
No.
He just said, if you're a Muslim, we're not going to process your application to come into this country.
No. And why is that so bad? Hey, let me ask you this. Craig, are you allowed to go to Canada?
If I do, I'm going to be arrested.
Okay. Why?
Because I told the truth about Islam. I quoted from the Quran and Hadith, and Canada is one of those countries that has a law against telling the truth if the truth hurts people's feelings.
Okay. And if you get a DUI
mm-hmm.
in America, are you allowed to move to Canada?
No.
You are not?
No.
So how is that?
Right.
And you get a DUI, you made a choice. If
right.
you're a Muslim, you made a choice.
You made a choice. Yeah, I was in a store today, and this older woman dressed in Islamic gear shopping in the women's department. I was with my wife, and I'm not really into that sort of thing, but I am into my wife, and she wanted to buy some clothes for my daughter-in-law. So I was a good husband after lunch. I walked with her and said, yep, that looks good. Nope, not my favorite. And all that was a fun experience. But Muslim was, you know, covered head to toe in religious dress up. And I just snarled at her. And he said, how in the world can you be so stupid that you'd play religious dress up at the advice of a man who treated women so poorly? He was a pedophile and a rapist. You're out of your ever-loving mind.
To you go even further, it's not like it's a hotbed for women's rights over there right now.
Why would you identify yourself with a religion that commits 99% of the world's terrorist acts? I just don't get it. But can you imagine the times that we live in now and just how stunningly weird, so despicable, bizarre?
We talk about it all the time at home. It just I don't know what. I know all this is happening. I know what Yahweh said would happen. It's just to watch it.
Right.
It's unbelievable. It's just like,
right.
Y'all are totally insane. And then.
Yeah. And then to see the two political parties in America literally dissolve before our eyes. I mean, you've got on the Democratic side, they're not talking about its destruction, but you've got a guy that's actually hammering a party favorite, beating her, state after state, who's a communist. And he's not even a Democrat. He is, he's a communist, and he is promoting nothing but class warfare and hatred of those who are productive. And he should be scaring Americans because the vast preponderance of those under 40 are voting for him.
Oh, yeah.
Which tells you it's just a matter of time between now and the time that the majority of Americans will favor socialism, robbing the productive to create a dependent lifestyle for the unproductive.
When Russia did that, though, there was the United States and Europe who would send them wheat for
right.
and then forgive the debt.
Right. Yeah, and build their and build their factories so they can make war equipment to kill our soldiers. Yes. And and yet still 40 million Russians died in the first 20 years of the experiment. When China decided they were going to experiment with the communism, 40 million people died in the first 10 years.
Yeah.
You know, Cambodia decided it was going to do the same thing. One out of every three people died. Most of them tortured.
And there was over 1.5 million killed in Laos, and nobody ever talks about that one.
Right.
We're just insane.
Yeah, it's just utterly insane. You know, the communists were so compassionate in Vietnam that if you didn't side with them, they would cut off your arm. They would hack you to death.
For a farming community, that's if you survive, you're dead. It just
Gosh, I mean, we are in a time where people are just absolutely incapable of thinking. It's either that they do not have a functional desalma, they don't exercise it, and therefore it is atrophied, or they don't have one. I don't know what the issue is, but we have reached a period of time where it is just absolutely stunning.
Well, Roy
how stupid
tells me they just don't have an Osama, and I'm absolutely about on his side completely now. I think it's dead. It may have one, but it ain't working.
No. Matter of fact, on the seventh chapter of Observations for Our Time, it's a chapter I've completed. I'm right now in the midst of reordering it. Our good friend IQ Al Rasuli and I were corresponding this week, and he asked me to send him some of the things I was currently writing. And as he was trying to read it, he was struggling with understanding it. And he had asked me to. He says, "You know, the style that you had in Prophet of Doom, where you'd present the verse and then you would just systematically rip it apart." He says, I don't have that here, so I don't have anything to grip onto, so it's really hard for me to follow. Now, I understand that this book was written for people who have read your other books probably multiple times and have grown through this process over a decade, and I'm trying to jump into the middle of, you know, your, whatever it is, 17th, 18th book.
Yeah.
But I'm having a tough time understanding this. And so I decided that I would take the format that I've been using, which is to write a quick summary of what we had just reviewed at the end of each section, and take that summary, remove the Hebrew words from it, and bring it forward.
Yes.
So I would introduce, here's a, you know, this is the next area of discussion from Yahweh. Here it is in just kind of one big gulp.
Right.
And with a minimal amount of amplification, but translated as accurately as I'm capable, but, you know, not painstakingly literal so as to make it difficult reading. So a little bit more relaxed in terms of the conversion from Hebrew to English grammar.
Yes.
And a little less amplified without the distraction of the Hebrew and nothing in the parenthetical. And here it is, you know, 5, 6, 7, whatever, 8, whatever number of verses we're going to dissect here. Present it first and then systematically dissect them one at a time. And so, anyway, I sent it off to him, and I'm now rewriting. I've rewritten 5, which we're in the midst of right now, 6, and I'm rewriting 7 to that new style.
But, and it works. I've been sitting here reading it, and it's absolutely, I'm sure first-timers, it's so much easier.
It's so much easier. So if it's easy, you know, I'm doing it because there's people that are, because prophecy, And the plight we're in today is more interesting to more people than anything else. So we're going to have people that are going to jump in with observations for our time as soon as it's posted. So we've got to make a transition so they come up to speed, because I can't go back and write like I did a decade ago. I know too much more now. So I can't go back and write like I did a decade ago, and I can't for those of us who have made it through this whole process, I can't go about and re-explain every term, because then it wouldn't be interesting to those of us who are trying to grow from where we currently are. But this is a nice compromise.
Mm-hmm. People have been talking about that recently on how and they've pretty well concluded what you've just concluded, and so I know it's going to find a lot of happy people when they see
it. Yeah, I think it. I'm convinced it's a better way to go, and I've gotten some feedback from Doe down in New Zealand has examined and sent back IQ. I've sent him chapters. Oh yeah, this is so much easier. He says now I'm really going to invest the time to read through this to understand it. But I went there because of the fact that at the end of the seventh chapter, Roy and I devoted would turn out to be 5-6 pages. Just to the Nesama.
Mm-hmm.
How it relates to our nefesh soul, how it works, how we get it, what cripples it. And so it's at the end of the chapter, there's a very thorough review. And I set the Nesama because the Nesama, I didn't know this, but you know the Nesama comes up at the towards the end of the second chapter of Yashaya. And God is asking us to avoid people whose nesama is off, APH. And and understanding what off is, because he's saying, you need to reject. You need to distance yourself. If you want to survive, you have to distance yourself from people whose nesama is off. And, you know, if you look up off, it's, you know, you'll read things like, where to for and therewith or something of that kind. Sometimes they say it's a word of negation, and no. This won't work as a definition. God is telling Nesama is a good thing. He's telling us to stay away from a people whose Nesama is associated with Omph. I need to figure out what that is.
Yeah.
You know what the first word that Satan's said to Chawa?
No, fill me in.
Umph. So as I'm trying to define this word, I said, this is an opportunity that I don't care how many hours it takes. I got to figure out what this word means. The first time it's used, it's the first word.
Looking up an English, the English word to get back to the Hebrew,
you'd read
word.
Something like nonetheless.
Okay. No.
Yeah. If you were reading it in an English Bible translation, and you wouldn't Nesama wouldn't be conscience. It would be something like breath of life. Nonetheless, the breath of life. You know, that kind of thing. But God has told you to stay away from these things. So you know, I had to figure out what it was, and so I looked up and analyzed the word as it appeared the first 7 or 8 times, and wow. It is someone harboring bitterness that creates hypotheticals that are designed to mislead and estrange others, causing them also to have some resentment. So it exposes Satan's resentment and religious people's resentment to God, and how they created these hypotheticals to cause others to share in their negative views.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a really interesting term. Anyway, at the end of the chapter, I've got the Nesama, I've got Omph, I've got the tree of life, I've got the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, how souls and Nesamas are passed on scientifically. It's kind of an interesting read for those that want a more scientific approach to what these things are and what they represent. So anyway, that's a long way from where we are right now, because we're still in the midst of chapter 5, which is the whore of religion. And I'd like to backtrack from where we ended our Shabbat program. We were in the midst of revealing, because we went through Proverbs 14 through about 14 through 19. We went through them if they were in Yahweh's voice, and it was ridiculous. There was a 0% possibility that they're in Yahweh's voice.
Yeah.
And then we went through them in the whore's voice, in Satan's voice.
Right.
And there are really some interesting insights when it's seen that way. And it's obvious that way because God is talking about how the whore solicits followers, how the whore goes about confusing people, misleading them. And so I want to start there again. It's Proverbs 7:14, translated from the whore's, in the whore's voice. It says, "The sacrifice of being killed as a peace offering to finish and fulfill the promise of fellowship was provided by me, the Almighty, the one day I fulfilled and completed and therefore finished once and for all my vows." I read that and my skin just crawls. It causes my guts to churn.
Mm-hmm.
And you might say, well, why?
Because of matzah.
Yeah, well, it's because of the way that Satan has woven a lie into religion, particularly Christianity, that is extremely difficult for most people to spot, and yet is absolutely devastating.
Yeah.
And that God told us the specific lie that Satan would use. The basis of Christianity is that God died for your sins. Man killed God. You know, if you go, if a Jewish school plays a Catholic school, the Catholics will yell at them that they were killers of Jesus.
And killed Jesus. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, as a matter of fact, the Jews couldn't do that. In fact, everything that Paul says about his orders from the high priest to go out and kill the followers of the way, and that he was doing it all over Israel, but now he was going outside of Israel to do it. They didn't have authority in Jerusalem, much less all over Israel, much less in any country, to do anything of the sort. They didn't have the authority to kill Yahusha.
Yeah, they had to send him back and forth.
They had to send him to the Roman governor,
mm-hmm.
The only person that could offer a death sentence. I mean, it is woven right into the story in the goddamn Christian New Testament.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, when Paul says that he was assigned that task, Christians aren't smart enough to say, wait a minute, how was it that the Jews had to send him to Pontius Pilate, and yet Paul was able, on their authority, to go out and kill anybody they wanted?
Because they never read the Torah.
Of course. You didn't even have to read the Torah.
They should know that,
read your own book.
Yeah, and say that. Why did they send him?
And put it together, and you'd say, oh, yeah, somebody's lying here. Anyway, the thing that causes me such grief here is that the basis of Christianity is that God was killed. Now, you don't have much of a God if man can kill him. That God was killed as a peace offering to have this great love fest and to resolve your sins. And it's all occurred on one day. You know, hold up your cross, the implement of the death that was used to kill God. Now, God can't be killed, folks. A God who could be killed by man isn't a God anyway. God cannot be killed. He cannot die. He did not die. He will not die. God is spirit, which is akin to light.
Mm-hmm.
He can't kill light.
No. Can't even kill Satan.
Can't even kill Satan. You know, there's a reason that God created the Sheol as a black hole to imprison Satan. There's a reason he tells you that he's going to imprison him for all time. Because he can't kill him. You can't kill a spirit. And, of course, your own book, if you're a Christian, tells you that the spirit left him. So you only had a soul and a body there.
Mm-hmm.
Only had a soul and a body.
And
the body died.
Mm-hmm. And the soul lived.
But the soul had already, but the spirit had already left. And so what was God left him. He only had a body there. God didn't die, a body died. Just like the Passover lamb.
Just like the Passover lamb.
Nothing more. And the soul, which is really the sign of life within a body,
mm-hmm.
That soul not only left and went into Sheol on the Shabbat, but it's that soul that was reunited with the spirit on Bukhurim that celebrate firstborn children.
Which explains an awful lot about that day, that event.
Right. The soul didn't die. The body died. And God most certainly didn't.